how do you design a transition into a Bitcoin world that doesn't trigger antibodies from the government and from the central banks?
Hello, I am Cody Allingham, and this is The Transformation of Value, a place for asking questions about freedom, money, and creativity. Today, I'm joined by Stephen Kerestagian. For over 20 years, Stephen has been exploring the questions of design, innovation, and disruption, working with some of the world's biggest brands, including Microsoft, Lego, and recently as head of global innovation at IKEA. But since discovering Bitcoin in 2017, everything has changed. Stephen has turned his focus to applying design thinking to this new form of money and how we might use it to build a more open and resilient financial system for the world. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Cody. That sounds like an amazing mission there that you put together.
Yeah, well, I mean, you've been working in this world, Stephen. You've been looking at design for some of these huge brands. And I think this question that sends a lot of Bitcoiners down the rabbit hole, so to speak, is what is money? But there is something that a lot of people don't talk about, which is the other question of this magnitude, which is what is design? Given your extensive experience, what does design mean to you, Stephen?
Wow. So those are two of the biggest questions that I still try to answer in my life. And then the what is money one, I guess, is one for all Bitcoiners and the one that I've incredibly become passionate about late in my life, actually, because of Bitcoin. But going back to the what is design, I guess that's something that I could at least try to answer from a place of confidence, being, you know, a designer and having worked in the industry 25 years almost. I'm kind of dating myself. But design, it could be many definitions, right? Design is basically applied art. You could describe it that way. It's using creativity to do something that has an application in life or in industry. You could say design is kind of like the Steve Jobs description of design, where he says design is not just about how things look, but it's really about how things work. And I agree with both of those. I would say that design is a creative process that uses, you know, technology and business in order to solve problems for people. And I think the part that says for people, it's probably the most important part as a designer, because as a designer, I try to be the representer of the person or the user in the participation of designing a solution, right? So you have the business people that are going to try to, you know, align with the business results and achieve certain profit. You have technology people that are really pushing the envelopes and building things at work. I love business, I love technology, but as a designer, I usually try to position myself as like the voice of the user. So representing the person that's going to be interacting with whatever solution this is. And in doing that, you basically have this you always have this client that you haven't met, which is the person that's going to be using this product, service, or experience that you're designing, and you want to do good by them, right? You want to represent what's important to them. You want to understand, be really empathetic and understanding like what their life is like, what's important to them, why are they even using this product, and then being using creativity in order to address that, right? To solve that. And when it all comes together, when you're able to balance, you know, a creative use of a technology, an application of technology, with some sort of business model that that creates revenue and it's profitable for the people that do it, and the customers are delighted, then you could probably say that was a really well-designed product or service, yeah, or experience. No.
Yeah, a good piece of design.
That's a long answer.
No, that's good. And so we're talking about sort of people-centered design here. And I mean, going back a step, I mean, there's this kind of field of design. I mean, I think it's really something that emerged after World War II, sort of post-war, this idea of building international design languages. I mean, the classic story of something like the Helvetica typeface you'll be familiar with. It's like used everywhere on street signs and things. Came out of Switzerland, and it was this kind of new way of communicating. It's about clarity, it's about communication, about breaking down barriers and bringing people together. And this has kind of come together in this global world we now live in, where maybe people speak different languages, but in a lot of ways, design is a universal language. You know, everyone knows, pinch to zoom and these kinds of things that we've found through something like the iPhone, right? These kind of gestures, these approaches to things. And you did write on your X, design is about, number one, how things work, number two, how things are experienced, and then number three, how things look in that order. Because a lot of people do get held up focused on the visual side of design, right?
Yeah. Yeah, the visual side is fun, but it's superficial, right? It's aesthetic. It's the way something looks. Now, that could certainly be part of the design strategy in communicating subconsciously to the user how something should be grabbed, the way, the delicacy or something, or which way to approach it, which way is forward, which way is back. So people that are not formally trained in design, they mostly experience design, or they're point at, when they talk about design, pointing at something aesthetic or some form or shape or color or combination thereof, right? And of course, as designers, we have the responsibility to make a final recommendation on those qualities. But if you study industrial design, which is basically a lot of, when I went to study industrial design, a lot of my friends and even my family didn't know what that was. And the way I would describe it, I would say, well, you know how architects design houses and buildings, and the fashion designers design clothing. Industrial designers kind of design everything else, right? Like all the products, all the services, combination of all these things. And then when you study industrial design, you really learn this very methodical process of how to apply these tools and these methodologies in order to solve a problem with creativity. So it's a practice. Like, it's not an idea thing. It's not something about, you know, having this sort of skill that you're born with. It's really like becoming really good at a skill. And the skill is applying a process that is a creative process that enables you to solve problems with technology and business and these other things. So yeah, design is a language. And then if you're a big brand, if you want to create like some sort of, you know, identity, then you could design your own design language and all of these attributes and all of these aesthetic and visual things that kind of compose and create this universe for you as a brand. Yeah. But I always take it back to the beginning for me. It's always about, there's a problem, there's a user, and how do you use creativity and all these other, whatever the tools, technology would be in order to solve that problem. So that's what design.
Yeah. Well, you said to me before that you had the privilege to design mass consumer products for hundreds of millions of people, and certainly your work with IKEA, which is a huge company all over the world selling, I'm imagining a lot of people have IKEA furniture in their houses, etc. What did you learn from working with a leading global innovator like IKEA about what design means at scale?
Yeah, it's the same lessons, right? Like, you know, whether you're designing something for IKEA, the mission of IKEA is to create a better everyday life for the many people. And it's kind of like an awkward translation from Swedish, the many people. But by that, I mean by as many people as possible. So if you think of the socioeconomic pyramid from the middle, like pointing down. So tons of data about regular folk, regular working folk, family, you know, middle class people that just get up every day and work, and they're trying to build, you know, a little nest egg, a little family for themselves. What are they worried about? What are the biggest problems that they have? And it's kind of the same no matter where you go, all parts of the world. People want the same things, right? People just want more time to do the things that they love, like hang out with their kids, like, you know, do their hobbies. They want to simplify their lives. You know, they want to de-stress. They don't want to be stressed about money or paying their bills. You know, they just want simplicity and time. It's very simple, right? So, you know, when you're designing a product for IKEA, like, you have to really be designing with that in mind. Same with, let's say you're designing a product for Lego. It's really about play and this expectation that the brand comes with. Every time you buy a Lego product, you have this expectation of discovery and creativity and learning through play and construction building and all this other stuff. So the bigger the brand, the bigger the responsibility is on the product that you're designing, and the less margin for error there is, right? So if you're doing a startup and you're trying to design or create something that doesn't exist, it's the first time ever that this product, service, experience exists, you're taking a little bit of risk, and you're filling in a lot of areas that are that you don't have answers for. So you can make mistakes. But when you're designing a consumer mouse for Microsoft in a specific category where it's consuming, where it's, you know, they sold 20 or 30 million last year, and this is the new version, there's no room for mistake. Like, you have to get everything right. You have to get the ergonomics right. You have to get the colors right. You have to integrate the right level of technology, whatever it may be at that stage of what you're doing. So that's what when you're designing products for large brands, you really rely on the process. The large brands can rely on individual creativity or skill sets. They have to rely more on teams and processes and validation and kind of going through that whole journey that lowers risk and sort of ensures that you have a successful product in the market. I sort of specialize in creating those teams and building those capabilities. So it's all really from creating a systematic iterative process where you're really understanding the users, you're up to date with the latest technology, you know what the competition is doing, you're kind of like, you know where the technology is going and sort of like fads and fashion and things are, you sort of combine all things to launch the right product at the right time with all of these things balanced. And to do that, it's just a lot of really hard work, really. It's just hard. Yeah. It's just a lot of hard work and iteration. And a lot of people think it's more creative and fun, but it's really, yeah, there's creativity involved, but it's a lot of hard work.
Yeah, it's a proof of work. It's fascinating. I'm really keen to understand your Bitcoin story, Stephen, because you had this incredible career working with these big brands on design, but then everything changed for you when you discovered Bitcoin. Tell me about that. How did you find out about Bitcoin?
Yeah, I mean, I stumbled into it as many people do. Like, when you work in design innovation, you're always looking at new technologies. And you're doing it so often that it's like, you know, every day, some new company, some new whatever, some new business model, some new gimmick, some cool new thing. So you're constantly gobbling through these things and sort of categorizing them in your brain, or you have some tools. And you run into technologies, and then you kind of, okay, this is kind of cool, this is kind of interesting, it has some potential. But, you know, it's hard to tell when you first take a glance at something if it's just one more thing, right? So the first time I saw Bitcoin, like many other people, I said, oh, this is really cool. It's a pipe dream. I don't think it's going to work. I forgot about it. And then in 2017, when all the hoopla on the ICO boom. Then, of course, in my regular work of, you know, just innovation and being up to date with all the disruptive technologies, like, okay, this thing is kind of still hanging out and sort of keeps coming back, this whole crypto space. And then I went back into it. So this is like summer 17, and I really looked into it. I read the white paper. I started reading some of the books, and I started, you know, I joined Bitcoin Twitter, basically, or Bitcoin X now. And then that really just opened it up for me. Like, I guess if you're a creative person and you work in innovation, you're more open-minded to new things. But it also, you're so curious that there's so many things to distract you as well. So that's my excuse for missing Bitcoin on the first time around. But the second time around, when I realized what it was, the potential that it had, the momentum that it had, that it grew out of this kind of embryonic stage and it's already big enough that it's becoming more anti-fragile. It just started cannibalizing my brain, man. I would bring it up in every meeting at IKEA in the boardroom, like, hey, what about Bitcoin, like payments? And it started to become, after maybe a couple of years, like an internal joke where, okay, Stephen, how is Bitcoin going to fix this other problem that we have? So it was good. We got some traction, some nice projects where I was able to kind of drive Bitcoin adoption, if you will, in this giant global company. But after a couple of years, it became evident that my appetite was much bigger than whatever projects or whatever it would come up in the context of the IKEA business. And I needed to put myself in a position where, one, I could really drive innovation and design in the industry, right? So work with the companies that are building the next generation products, be able to advise and participate in that somehow. And then two, I guess do like the Jeff Booth thing, stop being a hypocrite and like participate in the system that you really believe in, like exit the fiat system. You know, you wake up every morning, you contribute to this large global company, you're contributing to that system, right? If you really believe in the system, and you've convinced yourself and you've done the due diligence and you're several years in, then you start to get this pressure. It's like, all right, well, I guess you can just like be a participant on the side and save in Bitcoin. Or do you really want to, you know, impact the industry and have some sort of be an active participant in this transformation, this revolution. So then when I woke up too many days in a row having that itch, is when it became pretty evident that I had to walk away from what to more designers is a dream job, right? To start up as a designer, end up being head of global innovation at large organizations is not a very common thing for a design profile. So it was a difficult decision to walk away from a situation financially and work that you can see it all the way to you're retired and it's pretty stable and it's guaranteed, to walk away from that to kind of work full time in Bitcoin. But it's been a year and a half. I haven't looked back, so pretty excited to. I can't and even that, imagine going back to the fiat world anymore. So
yeah, and that's incredible. And I hope you don't mind me mentioning, but I mean, you also sort of relocated your life.
We went full in. No, so I was living in Scandinavia for the last little bit over a decade, working at these large companies, Lego, IKEA. That's where their headquarters are. But when I decided to go full-time Bitcoin, also I'm originally from Latin America, I was born in Chile. So the plan was always to come back to Latin America, but we decided to do a little bit of a detour and really kind of spend some time in El Salvador to really understand, instead of just reading about it or, just to really experience what type of transformation. And where are the wedge points where this technology really begins to transform society, and specifically from the Latin American perspective, where in El Salvador you have a very exaggerated situation where you have a country that a couple of years ago was really underdeveloped and really had some major structural issues and still does, and the just dramatic transformation that Bitcoin and a few other aspects. It's not just Bitcoin, but just to learn from that. And to really see how it's like from the grassroots perspective, people learn about it. And then from the top down, the banks and the large organizations. And this is really like a learning step for us before we relocate a little bit further down south in the Patagonia in Chile. And that's where we'll be the epicenter of all our Bitcoin work. So we'll be focusing our work in Latin America and South America.
That's incredible. So you're doing, in a sense, people-centered design here, where you're doing research on the ground. I mean, what have you learned about Bitcoin while you've been in El Salvador?
Oh, man, so much. There's a lot of, there's a huge gap still, right? Like, so you come to El Salvador, you go to El Zonte, you go to Bitcoin Beach, and, there's a couple hundred vendors that are accepting Bitcoin, and there's all of this interesting whatever expats and people from overseas, from Europe and the US, that are hanging around and they're having all these very sophisticated conversations. But if you just grab a regular cab from the airport, not one of the Bitcoin cabs, and they've heard about Bitcoin, they've never used it, but I still orange bill my taxi driver every time I come home from the airport. So there's this huge gap, right? Like there's a country where all the students from third grade up are being educated, are getting this financial literacy education. They're learning about AI, they're learning about Bitcoin. So you have this wave of really well, that's going to be amazing to see when these kids get old, and that whole wave of kids that are being, taught these skills so early on. So you have that, which is amazing. And then you have the people that are involved in the Bitcoin space. But then you have a lot of people sort of stuck in the middle that are, they haven't had a lot of experiences where they trust the government and good things happen change provides something positive. So they're very tentative, right? Mm. But slowly but surely, just in the year that I've been here, 7 months, you see the change, man. You see the advancement. It's just that you can't ignore it. Like just infrastructure, like everything, like every bridge is being fixed. Like it's just cleaner in the street. Just the advancements in the stuff that they're doing downtown. There's just energy here, man. Like when you just talk to people, they have this hope, they smile, they feel enthusiastic about whatever it is that they do. So that's pretty rare. I live in Scandinavia, so society that's known as being very happy, but people are very closed, and it's a very kind of lonely kind of society a little bit. People are not very social. Everything's structured and organized. here there's very few things that are structured and organized that work well, but the attitude is off the charts positive because people see the trajectory of the change. So there's a lot there. There's a lot to go when you think about, like, okay, a country makes Bitcoin legal tender or they open their arms to Bitcoin, it'll take decades for that to penetrate society, right? So I think it's a great pilot to learn of what works. And I think an important job to do is to identify what works here and then spread it, right? Take it to some of the other countries in Latin America. And we're involved in some of those activities with Bitcoin Beach and some of the other circular economies that are coming from here. So yeah, a lot to learn. It's all new. It's exciting, man. It feels exciting because it's something unique. It's not something that is top down from a marketing campaign or some. It's just kind of like this very real thing.
Yeah. Well, pulling on that thread, something I wanted to ask you about, as we mentioned before, you know, my background is design as well, and I respect and understand these processes. But there's also this kind of interesting aspect of emergent systems. And, you know, we're looking at a technology that some aspects of it are kind of unchangeable, some aspects are locked in. Other layers and other aspects can be designed for and improved and changed. And then there's also this market out there that's kind of pushing and pulling, and it's a global market, and we might think we have the answer, but actually, you know, it goes somewhere else. And there's this interesting dynamic, which is quite different to designing a product for a company top down, as you say. And so I wonder if you've reflected on this way, like open source projects and design can kind of come together in an emergent way that also has maybe aspects of design thinking involved.
Yeah, I mean, that's a super interesting topic, because one of the things or the realms or design or innovation that I became known for was, you know, this aspect of open innovation. So open innovation became kind of a hot topic, you know, maybe 5-8 years ago. And one of my job at Lego was senior manager of open innovation, really establishing that practice. What does it mean? What is the practice of open innovation? How does it work? And what is the difference between open innovation and traditional innovation? And it's interesting because it really aligns with the question that you had around Bitcoin. So traditional innovation in a corporate sense is you hire a team of engineers, designers, or creative people, innovation team, in order to create the future products and services, right? Or to solve whatever business problems. And then that team is responsible for it, and the innovation comes from that team. Open innovation is when that team kind of creates methods, tools, platforms, ways for other people to also participate in the innovation process. And the other people can be other people in the company, right? Like regular executives or other people that are not tasked with innovation or design. Or it could actually be the customers, or it could be industry, it could be competitors, right? So when it comes to so one of the most successful projects I did for Lego was this platform called Lego Ideas, which is a crowdsourcing platform where Lego basically flipped the model of, like, we design all the cool Lego sets and you buy them, to tell us what Lego sets we should do, you design them, and we'll make them for you. And so basically the fans become the designers of the Lego sets. And then there's a financial incentive and all this other stuff, right? So I learned a lot about open innovation. On open innovation, the magic trick to open innovation is that it's not that instead of having the experts design it, having the crowd design it, it's not instead of, it's yes and, is together with, right? So it's about having the experts that are really deep, for example, in a technical space, for example, like the Bitcoin core developers, they're the experts in the code, right? But designing the design process and and almost having like a transitional design process, where in the process you invite the different stakeholders to participate, therefore becoming part of the design process. So doing an open innovation approach. And I really think that that's what Bitcoin is, right? So Bitcoin is open source software. It required one lone genius to kind of put it all together and say, like, this is the thing, right? But then after that, it really requires this collective effort, and very complex, in order to improve or nudge or tweak or build on top of or, you know, evolve in time. So it's probably the most important open innovation project in existence today, behind the other kind of open source projects that it replaced. And not only is it the biggest, it's fuck, it's the most important one, right? Because it's about the foundational layer of value. So yeah, man, I guess I would say that there is a role for the design process, the open innovation process, the collective design process to play in the Bitcoin protocol. And I hope that someday that becomes part of the conversation a little bit, especially with the recent topics that are going on with the up returns and all this other stuff. Like, yeah. Where is the center of expertise? Right? Is it core? Or is it the community? Or is it everybody? Right?
If I can pitch maybe a little bit more complexity to that question. So obviously you have the protocol and kind of these base open source layers, but of course there's an ideological component, which is that everything built upon that should be open source and private and all of these kind of attributes that maybe we think are important. And that leads to this kind of push and pull where businesses building at higher layers are also expected to be open source, and they're sort of, there's like a social narrative. And that reality, though, that we see is that a lot of people are using exchanges, they're using things that are, you know, basically traditional businesses built on top of Bitcoin. And maybe we think, oh, you know, that's not the right way, you should self-custody all of this stuff, right? And there's this kind of push and pull between the convenience for someone who maybe doesn't care about the ideological aspects and then this kind of the bigger idea that actually birthed the whole thing. So sorry, there's a little bit of complexity there, but how would you unpick those ideas?
It's just, that's the way life is, right? Like you will, if I were to design a product for me, and I am a single, super sophisticated designer living in a New York lofty studio, and I might, you know, have some rendering, some visionary or idea of how I'm using or interacting with this product, right? But the reality of it is that it's probably, you know, a couple with some kid that's crying and the food is there from last night and it's all, it doesn't look the way that you ideally visualize in your head, right? So that happens all the time. It's like you're not designing products for you or for this perfect persona that you visualize. You're designing products for real people that have real needs and have real priorities and considerations and worry and things that they worry about and just lives, right? They have their lives. So I think that just is amplified in the Bitcoin space, where you have the Bitcoin maxis and a lot of the core developers, people that have been here for a long time, they have these super strong ideas about Bitcoin the movement, right? Or Bitcoin the cultural movement, or Bitcoin the ideology, right? And I agree with a lot of those things. I mean, I align myself with a lot of those thoughts. Just like I align myself with having this perfect studio kitchen or whatever, that everything's clean and neat and simple. But that's not the reality of my life, right? That's not the reality of my life. The reality of most people's lives is that if you take the time to explain to them what self-sovereignty is, they'll agree with it and they want it. And that's the last time they'll think about it until they see you again and you bring the subject that subject back to them again. Like these things that we at Bitcoin Maxis are super passionate about, 99.99% of people don't care about, and they will never care about. It's not that, let me just explain it to them a little harder, and then they'll develop the sensitivity to these. They're never going to care about it. And it doesn't make them stupid or dumb or anything. They're just people. They're getting up in the morning, they're feeding their kids, they're running off to school and to work, they're trying to get some exercise done, they're trying to learn something, they're trying to live their lives. They don't have time or energy in their lives to care about these things. So we need to design products for those people. Because if not, we're just designing products for what? 10,000 people, 10,000 Bitcoiners? How many of us are there that really feel this way? So I don't believe that we should, I mean, there should be products that are super aligned with these values, that are completely open source, that are, you know, privacy oriented, all these things. And there will be other products that are solving other problems for other people that don't care about that. And it just depends what market you're designing for and what person you're designing for. And we should just get away from this. It's two separate things. I really align with this thing. It's like there's Bitcoin the tool, and then there's Bitcoin the ideology. And you could do either one. You don't have to do both. You could do just the tool.
Yeah, I think that's That's an interesting question for me. I have reflected on this because, you know, I mean, obviously both of us are, I got a little bit X in the corner there. I got my node. You know, we got all the gear and the stuff.
It's geeky. It's cool. I mean, I love it.
Yeah.
But I know most people don't care about it. They actually think it's geeky and dumb, and what's the point, right? Like,
yeah. And I mean, not to, you know, drag it out, but like on that note, I guess I'm really interested in this IKEA experience that you've had, right? You know, designing for what's almost a billion people potentially in the market for this furniture and these items. And, you know, you've got people from all corners of the world. I have an IKEA here in Japan. You know, it's all over the world, different languages, different people. And one of the challenges is if you have this kind of ideology about the way it needs to be and it's all locked in, it actually becomes exclusionary and it actually goes against maybe some of the ideas of design about, you know, meeting people where they're at, you know, trying to understand what their pain point is. What is the challenge that we're trying to solve for? Because yeah, in some places, maybe it's an inflation question. We don't like seeing our value decrease. But for other people, maybe they've got other priorities. They're trying to just put food on the table every day. Maybe they can't even use traditional payment systems. They're in a country that doesn't have Visa credit card systems or whatever. There's all these different use cases, right? And I guess zooming out, I mean, how do we approach this? I mean, is this where companies come in and they find the problems that they can solve and then there's an incentive for them to solve that problem? Or is this something that happens at an open source level? I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
It comes full circle to where we began the conversation, right? Applying the design process. That's what the design process was designed for, and that's literally what it is. It literally is the process of understanding what problem people have, an industry, a society, whatever customers have, and then designing the most appropriate solution so that they love it and they pay you for it, right? So again, if we're saying we're doing that, but only under the vision of this ideology, then you're not doing that, right? Because then you're filtering everything. You're assuming that they have the same whatever hierarchy of whatever of thought or priorities that they have. So again, Bitcoin is a tremendously powerful tool. It's tremendously powerful. We're just beginning to understand all the different things that we can do with it. But just with the things that we already know we can do with it are tremendous. I mean, all the stuff that you can do with energy, the stuff that you can do on sovereignty, savings, banking, payments. I mean, it's amazing, right? It's not enough. You have to wrap it in a really beautiful, simple, usable, you know, functional product. And you have to communicate that product in a very simple way that really aligns with whatever problem or whatever incentive some person has. So design, that's what design does. It's like, okay, well, what are we trying to solve? We're trying to, you know, save people time or save people money or a combination of both or make payments easier or whatever it is. Communicate that in the language and from the perspective of how those people are experiencing that problem, right? So those people will never use some of the words that many Bitcoiners and founders use to kind of explain their value proposition to the world. Oh, we're trying to build this, blah, blah, blah. So people are like, I don't even know what those words mean. Yeah. So I think it's about that. It's about sensitizing the founders and the people building in Bitcoin with these proven methodologies, with these processes, which are just really understanding the customer, you know, applying creativity and technology on these things in order to design better products. So the products are not going to compete. They're not going to outcompete the status quo just because Bitcoin is better technology. They have to also have equally or better UX experience, communication, you know, product market fit, all of these things, right? So, you know, you have professionals that know how to do that, and you got to bring those professionals to Bitcoin.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I mean, one observation I've made certainly from a creative lens is that Bitcoin is heavily it's an engineering, it's a geeky kind of a thing. There's a lot of tech, and I mean, it's gotten a lot better over the last few years, but even, you know, some of the stuff that we do, I would consider maybe more infrastructure stuff, running nodes and running mining equipment. You know, there's a little bit of geeky kind of technical, or quite a bit of engineering knowledge needed to kind of get into that world. But I just want to come back. At the beginning, I mentioned like Helvetica, this font, this typeface that came out of Switzerland. Everyone's maybe familiar with it. It's what you see on highway signs. And It's a little bit apocryphal, but sort of the story of that is that it replaced a lot of the Gothic script and the sort of big fat, you know, writing they used to have in Germany and Switzerland back before the war, and it became this very clear universal kind of language. And I wonder whether, just zooming out a little bit, the real big piece here, we're asking this question about money, and money is intrinsically linked with the state and the government, and it's kind of bigger question of value. And so we're in this interesting place where there is necessarily, though, to understand Bitcoin, there is an ideological project there, which is, well, what is the role of the government and the state in our money? And a kind of, in the same way that Helvetica asked the question, well, you know, what was the role of Germany, you know, during the war, and what was this role of, like, miscommunication, basically, in Europe that led to this whole movement of what we see now, basically, with Europe as this this project. In the same sense, I think Bitcoin prompts this question of, like, well, what is a world without state money, without the state controlling money, look like? And so necessarily it becomes a political, ideological question. And I just wonder, I mean, how do you work with these things? Because I don't know if it is just a product like designing a lampshade for IKEA, which doesn't really have a political power, if you know what I mean. Like, it's always going to butt up against the government. And how do you square that?
Yeah, it's kind of like more layers of complexity to the design challenge or the design problem, right? So yeah. I have this presentation that I give. It's really about the 25 year trajectory of me as a designer. Like, what were the material that I was designing with 25 years ago? Well, 25 years ago, I was designing with molten plastic, like injection molded plastic and circuits, right? I was doing consumer products with that. But then the internet came and all this digital, then you were designing with like bits and pixels and all this kind of more interactive and servicey and interaction stuff. And then lately now you're kind of designing, and this is kind of a sophisticated conversation, but you're designing with data, right? And AI. That's really what you're designing with. That's the most kind of like the most sophisticated material to design with, is with data and AI, and you can do really sophisticated, you know, product services. And then I say, like, then you have Bitcoin. Then you can design with Bitcoin. Like, it's not instead of all these things. It's yes and, right? So injection molding and circuits and networks and bits and pixels and data and AI and Bitcoin, right? So then the level of complexity is like, what does it mean to design with Bitcoin? So yeah, you're kind of like everything, right? So it's not just the material and the digital stuff. It's kind of like it's a new asset class. It's a new material class to design with, right? Because imagine you design a product that is Bitcoin compatible. It means things what that product inherently does is something that no product ever in history could have inherently done, which is, it's compatible with everybody in the world. Everybody in the world can buy or sell this or transact this thing, because you designed it with this new amazing material, which is Bitcoin, right? So I would say that to your question, there's many more layers of complexity of how you're designing. So with Bitcoin, yeah, you could design how it makes a payment faster or some compatibility it's universal, whatever it may be. But also you have to how do you design a transition into a Bitcoin world that doesn't trigger antibodies from the government and from the central banks? Like, how do you design, there's a term in design called transition design. So you're kind of designing the steps. You can't go to the final finished new version, because it's too much and the world's not ready and the technology is not mature enough or whatever it may be. But you're designing transitional steps for that. And when it comes to Bitcoin, man, this is such a compelling conversation, because I worked at I don't put it in my resume because it was only a year, but I worked at Kodak for 1 year. I was leading the innovation department at Kodak for 1 year. Kodak invented the digital camera, right? And this is known, right? And then they put it in a closet because they had this amazing business selling the film cameras, right? But there's nothing that Kodak could have done to prevent digital photography from taking over. It was just kind of like, okay, well, we'll milk it for a little bit and we'll make some money and we'll delay as we make money here. But you know, when you think about Bitcoin, what it's replacing, it's not replacing, like, you know, I mean, you say, okay, what replaced Kodak? Oh, okay, it was a combination of Facebook and, you know, whatever in the film industry, it was Netflix and all this stuff. When you think about, like, Bitcoin, what is Bitcoin replacing? Shit, man, Bitcoin is replacing or is disrupting the most powerful institutions in the history of the world, right? So central banks and central governments, right?
Yeah.
So then how does that play out, right? And how do you design a transition, or how do you design the steps going from a world where Bitcoin doesn't exist to a world where Bitcoin replaces a lot of these things? I mean, the answer is we're living in it, right? And it's impossible for a designer of me to like sit back and just see it happen. It's like, I don't know the answer, but I feel that I need to participate in figuring it out.
Well, on that note, so I think we're on the same wavelength with this, because the engineering mind, I think, wants more certainty. It wants to see at a protocol level that this is happening in the way it was expected, and it's doing what it is expected to do. But I think we're thinking maybe more in this visionary creative space, where it's playful. And I'll give you an example of that. You know, I'm just the dude, right, you know, doing this thing. But I've had these conversations with very high-level people, including former governor of the Reserve Bank of New Zealand, former governor of the Bank of Japan, these like central banker dudes. I've been in the room with them, and I'm like talking about Bitcoin, and I'm wearing like my funny clothes and my orange trousers and stuff, and I'm like this crazy dude. But it's like the whole pathway to me getting to those conversations, having this podcast, meeting other people, traveling around the world. It's like that's just only been possible through Bitcoin, and like, I don't know. It's kind of strange. It's like a real provocation.
It's the strangest thing ever, man. Like the people that I'm hanging out with now, who my friends are, like all the people that you met, and the only reason why you met them is because of Bitcoin. Or like when you go to a conference and you meet some new people that you haven't met before, you know that you kind of aligned 80% already just because they're at a Bitcoin conference. And you know, a lot of Oleg, the head of Fogo, says Bitcoin is an IQ test. So basically saying like there's a group of people, for whatever reason, maybe they're quirky, maybe they're like working innovation like I do and they're always looking at new things, or they really love technology and they study computer science, or they're into whatever, social sovereignty, whatever. For whatever reason, there's this group of people that came onto Bitcoin before the rest of the world. And it's like there's like a gap there. These people keep getting richer, deeper understanding of Bitcoin and the potential and everything that is happening. And then these other people are just ignoring it, or just, you know, just they've heard the word but they don't know anything about it. And like and there's this pressure building up. Like eventually, you know, there's gonna be some sort of balancing out of what happens here. But how do we make it as least painful as possible, right? How do we design products and on-ramps for these people? And I think that most of these people are going to be using Bitcoin without knowing they're using Bitcoin, right? Nobody knows how a cell phone works. Nobody knows how TCP/IP, the internet works. They just use it, right? So to me, that's the role of design. It's like people don't need to understand Bitcoin or know how it works in order to benefit from it.
Yeah, well, I mean, pulling on that thread, so as I mentioned, you know, I've met these people, I've had these conversations, and it's been very interesting because there's something, and it kind of maybe echoes your work with Lego in a sense, but there's something very playful and provocative about it, but not in an aggressive way. It's more like, I enjoy kind of floating between these worlds and meeting different people. And obviously Bitcoin is a fun to hang out with, but it's also fun to go, you know, I go to the press club, I go to meet with different people and in the legacy financial world. I have these conversations, and it's kind of like I can see that they are constrained and they've got this sort of straitjacket on that's sort of holding them in. And in a lot of cases, it means they can't see what we see. And the interesting piece, though, is that a lot of that kind of the regulation or the actual, you know, fundamentals that are stopping them from changing what they're doing, say, you know, there's some legal restrictions or whatever, those things can be changed. They just take time. And so there's this kind of process, this social process. And so I'm a big believer in communication and meeting people where they're at, because in a lot of cases, you know, the people maybe haven't made the jump to Bitcoin. It's because they can't just yet. You know, their company won't let them do it. The laws of the country they're in won't let them do it in the way that we, you know, they would want to do. And so there's this kind of social process where the more you socialize it, the more you disrupt it, you become like a free agent who's kind of just like, hey, what are you guys doing? And it's kind of playful. And I think you see this with like the fashion and the conferences, and I mean it's quite eclectic, a little bit hippie.
And I don't know if that plays for or against it, right? Because I work with quite closely with Plan B Network, and you're familiar with these guys. They do Bitcoin education, and they do events, and they have Giacomo, who's a fantastic shitposter, as sort of the head of the organization, and they have this quirky kind of branding and identity, right? That is kind of, you know, cyberpunky-ish, but kind of weird and kind of teenagey. Like, it doesn't attract a lot of serious people, right? Like, if you're a serious entrepreneur or in finance, you see some of these kind of bigger voices in Bitcoin, and you're just, maybe you're trying to figure out, like, what is it? Like, these guys, are they just quirky? Are they nerdy? Or they're just cool and I'm not cool? I'm not in the crowd. So I don't know. I wonder. I think that's something cool about Bitcoin. If you know it, you know the memes and everything. But if you're outside and you know anything about it, and that's one of your first experiences with it, it could set you back, or maybe even, you know, not be a very attractive first.
Or maybe this impression. Maybe this is where. Yeah, I understand. Maybe this is where people like you and me can come in, or maybe creative people, you know, because I do enjoy floating between these worlds, man. And as I said, I got the thing going, the Bitcoin angle, but I'm also very comfortable and I enjoy talking to people. I think in a non-judgmental way, I really think it's just important to talk to people, what we would call normies. But even then, I think that label, it's sort of, I don't know, it's interesting when other so-called subcultures refer to people outside their group as normies, and you see this in a lot of other worlds, and it's kind of like, hey, some people, as you say, you know, they're just busy with life, they haven't got time to think about this thing that they have to put on their computer, or this, you know, the software they got to download, you know, they haven't got time to think about it. And so I think coming at that like in a non-judgmental way, and it's like, well, hey, you know, they're busy
also, it's
know?
Not relevant to that, man. Like, yeah. Also enjoy, I mean, you know, being a senior executive at these giant companies, I'm super used to walking to the boardroom, and you know, you gotta, it's an art form of what you say and how you say it, if you want support and all these, you know, sort of things. And you gotta be empathetic to these people, their jobs and their reality and their family, you know, they're just not aware of all the stuff that you're doing. So all of this Bitcoin kind of meme stuff and this vocabulary, I mean, we have a vocabulary in Bitcoin, really. I mean, there literally is like a vocabulary, it's like a subculture, right? It's weird because if you've been in it long enough, it seems pretty normal and like you know all these words. But just step 2 meters outside your house, and if people would overhear us talking, they don't know what half these words mean, right? So I don't know. I think we make a mistake as Bitcoiners when we take that to the regular world. Like if it's something that it's gonna, I don't think that's gonna scale. Like that cultural click thing is only for the people that are already like this. Like it's us. It's like the geeky, nerdy people that are into Bitcoin, the early adopters. Like that culture, I don't think is compatible at a large scale. Like a lot of people won't be, I don't think, I don't know. Maybe it's...
Yeah, I think I agree. I think there's different priorities that people have. And I mean, of course, money is important, but I mean, it's not really just about the money. Because I mean, there is risk. You know, obviously the risks
are
kind
of known.
Yeah, what if we're wrong? You know, and the counterfactual, you know, there's whole the power of the government and the kind of the nature of economics. You know, like there's lots of things there that, I mean, we should be maybe a little bit humble about, that maybe we don't know. Because again, the question earlier around design versus emergent creation, I come back to someone like Friedrich Hayek, you know, the classic Austrian economist that everyone maybe quotes. They look at Austrian economics for Bitcoin insight. But Hayek said, "The curious task of economics is to demonstrate to men how little they really know about what they imagine they can design." And he also says, "Order generated without design can far outstrip plans men consciously contrive." That is to say, sometimes things just happen and there's maybe just a confluence of events in the world.
You have to leave space for it. I mean, it's about I talk a lot about process and sort of this more linear methodical thing to arrive at an opportunity to some sort of solution. But inside that process, there's a lot of iteration and there's a lot of room and space for serendipitous discovery, if you will. And when it comes to, like I mentioned before, the open innovation, that's what it really drives on. Because when you have an internal very high-performance team that's doing something very specific, it's more predictable than when you're inviting other, you know, customers, other people to participate. You will inevitably discover or things that you could not predict will happen. Like somebody will have a problem that you weren't even thinking that Bitcoin can solve, or somebody would have some sort of creative approach or seeing something that nobody else could see before. So I guess what I'm saying, what I want to say relative to your question was, for Bitcoin, because it's such a new thing, and we don't have many things to reference or compare it to. I think that anytime we make a design or we have an opinion about it, we have to do it with kind of like the space for wiggle, this wiggle room for like learning. So
yeah.
I think it's, maybe I'll quote Jeff Booth again, but like strong opinions weekly held. So you have a strong opinion, this is my vision, this is what I want to do, but I could easily be convinced or see something new that will open my mind and change my mind. So sort of, that's the way I would approach design with Bitcoin, because we don't know what we don't know, man. And so far, it's just all this done is surprise us, right? So I don't think it's going to stop doing that anytime soon.
Well, and I think the other aspect just on design is looking at the environment in the sense of what is the lay of the land, what is happening out there in the world. And I don't know about you, I'm starting to get this kind of feeling that maybe there is a bit of a bubble with basically the whole stock market and the whole AI thing, in a sense that maybe the things are being pumped. And I could be wrong, but say there is a huge bubble and basically a lot of people in the developed world have their wealth tied up in stocks and the stock market. You know, if we were to have a hypothetical situation where that thing blows up, the magnificent seven, you know, major companies that run the whole thing, basically, that goes, and then people are like, hey, we need something hard, we need hard money, and we see those people suddenly sort of come back into gold, Bitcoin, you know, those kind of hard commodities. That could be like, again, one of these things that it doesn't really relate to what we're designing with our Lightning wallets, but that's like the kind of environmental backdrop that could happen. I don't know, but that could suddenly be like, hey, everyone suddenly reassesses everything they're doing, because suddenly real estate, stocks, equities, all of these things are just like tanking. They need somewhere else to go. And that's like the hard money moment. And it's hard to get your hands on gold. So what are you going to do? You're going to go and get some Bitcoin that you heard about 5 years ago.
You're kind of describing what's slowly sort of happening, right?
I mean,
and we had a little mini crash or too many crashes in the stock market this week. I mean, yeah, it's a good question. Like, how do you... Do you change your approach to designing in a world where Bitcoin is this tiny little thing, 1% trying to break through, trying to like make a case for itself, to a world where like, shit, everybody has Bitcoin and we're just kind of on our heels trying to come up with the products and the things to service these people that, you know. So a lot of the Bitcoin companies today, their whole value proposition is convincing people why they should even consider Bitcoin, right?
Yes.
It's not about like, here's the best way to manage your Bitcoin and all this other stuff. So I don't know. It's That's why it's the most exciting space to be designing in, man. Like, they're not even AI. Like, seriously, like AI, yeah, sure. AI is super interesting. You can do so many things. What I find, I just came back from giving a talk to the Chamber of Commerce in Chile. And they had all the talks, and every talk had something about AI, right? And I was the only one that was going to talk about Bitcoin. And I really drove in the point and wanted to talk about Bitcoin. And my position on that is that, like, look, I think AI and Bitcoin are by far the most, you know, transformational, revolutionizing, disruptive technologies, especially today. But the difference is that everybody knows AI is, and everybody's talking about it, and everybody's getting consultants, and everybody's doing something about AI. Bitcoin is equally impactful, and almost nobody is prepared or doing anything or even, you know, getting ready, especially large corporations. It's tiny. That's a tiny percentage of the companies who are educated or have any sort of plan for adopting Bitcoin or integrating Bitcoin, whether it be in the, you know, in the treasury or, you know, into the products and services. So the gap between the opportunity and the kind of people people working on that opportunity, there's a much bigger hole to fill in Bitcoin than in AI, I would say. And the potential impact of both technologies, I could almost argue that Bitcoin is bigger. So there's like a disbalance of people focusing on Bitcoin talent, creatives, you know, designers, founders, technical people. So that's why I think there's a huge opportunity there. It's like there's like an arbitrage, there's a mismatch there from demand and supply that'll soon become very evident, I think.
Yeah, I think I agree with you. There's sort of why Bitcoin, you know, and especially in a lot of places, you know, where the money is maybe not so great, but it still works, and it's, you know, it's manageable. It's just kind of it's decaying at just slow enough of a rate that you don't really care about it in above the noise of your daily life. And I think what we may see is that you know, continues along for some time, but in other places maybe it accelerates. You know, you get this kind of global chaos happen, maybe maybe some kind of bubble with the stock market, and then that suddenly pushes people towards looking at alternatives. But it's kind of like, what are those pain thresholds? And this is quite common, you know, like what is the threshold at which someone will change their actions? And often, you know, there is a stickiness, a bias towards the status quo. You know, and there's this, like, you see this, like, people get like a bank account when they're a kid or when they're a young person, and it's generally going to be the one they stay with, at least up until recently. You know, it's because the friction to change is higher than the value of changing between banks, right? And so there's kind of these kind of models can be applied as well. Like, at what point is it 10%? Is it 15%? That is your threshold that you're going to say, hey, I'm going to suddenly look and be compelled to look at an alternative. And again, I think that because it's like fluffy and fuzzy, it's kind of hard maybe for an engineer to be like, hey, that's where it's going to happen. But I mean, this is the nature of society, right? It's kind of like fluid and changing and dynamic, right?
Yeah, and how do you design for those things? Again, like so that example that you gave, the first bank account, right?
Yeah.
Just that's a full-blown product in the regular normie world, right? Like a company that says, hey, we have this product that any kid anywhere in the world can create a bank account for free that lasts forever, and anybody, their relatives or anybody, can deposit into it, and when they turn 18, they could have this money. That you could literally do that with Bitcoin in a second, right? Like that's just part of the Bitcoin's base functionality. That could be a business in the regular world. There's probably VCs that will still be funding some sort of business idea like that, right?
Yeah.
So the opportunity is so obvious and great that it's kind of hard to kind of, okay, well, what opportunity do I kind of go after, right?
With
Bitcoin. So it just changes things so dramatically that that's why it's a change of paradigm, right? It kind of forces you to like, you know, okay, well, how do I interact with this thing? But the one thing that I, you know, from my perspective, from my level of expertise, is like, okay, whoever you're designing for, whoever these people are, they're people. So they experience products and services through convenience, through simplicity, through delight. That's never going to change. That's always going to be the case. And they're going to prioritize choosing a product or buying the service or whatever it be relative to the priorities and the things that are important in their lives, right? And design is the formal practice of understanding that and designing solutions for that. So if you have the most powerful tool to solve problems for society, oh man, what an awesome opportunity to apply world-class design to that most powerful tool and design products that are not just cheaper, faster, more intuitive, like orders of magnitude better. But it's not so hard. Like, again, that example that you just shared is that. Like, just think about that for a second. Like, it sounds normal in the Bitcoin world, but 10 years ago, outside of the Bitcoin world, what if I had a product that every child in the world could be born and have a bank, a savings account that lasts forever, that nobody can ever take away, that is there from the, and that's a product that you can do with Bitcoin. And that's just one out of thousands of products that you can do, man. So, I don't know, man. As a creative, as a designer, you got to just smile at that and be like, wow, man.
Yeah, there's a real opportunity. And look, man, I think, again, my kind of, my antenna, the vibes out there, I think the world is changing. I think maybe there has been reluctance, and there's, you know, a lot of people, you know, they require convincing, even though number go up, you know, that is pretty convincing on its own. But
I would have thought by the number go up level that it's now, more people would just be, just because of that, you know?
Yeah, but so, I mean, as I said, you know, look, I have compassion that I understand still people are a little bit skeptical of it, and there has been number go up in other aspects of the economy, you know, especially stock market. And so there is something going on there, but I do think these narratives can change on a dime. And again, I'm reminded of the Helvetica story, the idea of having typeface fonts that are just easily communicated and make it clear. I'm reminded of the internet story, having this global peer-to-peer money. It kind of echoes the way the internet sort of was, you know, designed to connect people together. And whether, you know, even though that came from the military originally, which is quite interesting. But the bigger piece here is that there is the possibility that we're entering a new narrative story time where the world's approach to money, to value, is able to be shaped. And I think this is where like the human stories can really help. And maybe what you're seeing in El Salvador, what we're seeing in Latin America, is really interesting. You know, there's kind of a humanizing aspect. It's not just about, you know, getting rich, you know, number go up, but it's actually like, hey, this is helping families, it's helping people save. There's kind of like a good story there. And I think telling those stories is really important as well. And kind of sharing that kind of human aspect of it beyond the technology.
Yeah, because the technology kind of disappears, right? Like when, if you live in a world where anybody can exchange value with anybody, right? And the entry barrier is super low. It's basically a $50 phone. And then you just step back and say, like, what will people do? It's a superpower, right? This new thing. Anybody, I can exchange, I can create value in exchange. I get paid or send money to anybody in the world. Nobody can stop me. So that's the thing. It's like, what will people do? That's amazing, right? Like as a designer, somebody who's building a product, okay, I will do this. But the real interesting thing is like the culmination of all the creative people coming up with ideas and things like this, what will people do? And they will do some amazing things, right? So you know, what can we do to help people do these things, right? How do we highlight these new superpowers that are enabled by Bitcoin? How do we make it easier for people to realize the power that they already have because this technology exists? You know, those are communication problems, right? They're like perception problems. They're like when like every time I talk to a cab driver from the airport at home and I ask him about Bitcoin, of course he's heard about it because he lives in El Salvador and he hasn't used it. And why haven't you used it? And then he might have this perception of like he doesn't want to be stuck or it's going one time it went down or he can't change it. And at the end, it's like, oh, because you don't know about this other app or whatever, Blink. You can have your dollars, you can have your thing, you can have it there. And in 3 seconds, he downloaded a new app. I paid him in that new currency, and all of a sudden, he's onboarded. So it's just really like that had to do exactly what you said, like meeting him where he was at. Like he heard some government campaign, he went to something, but he never had like a one-to-one conversation with somebody that just simplifies it. And here, give me your phone, download this app. Okay, here, I just sent you some Bitcoin. It's that easy. Like, I was intimidated. I thought it would be way harder. I thought I had to learn. I had to know about all this technical stuff. I was like, no, you can just use it. So I love that, like filling in that gap. Like, how do you design experiences that provide that experience at scale to people?
Yeah.
We haven't cracked it yet.
Yeah. No, it's exciting times. And I think there's sort of a, there's a mission statement in what you just said. Making it easy for people to transfer value between each other globally without trusted third parties. It sounds a little bit like the Bitcoin white paper, actually, as a mission statement.
Yeah, but then statement. You realize you can never do that before. You could do that right now. What will you do, right?
Yeah.
What will you do? What will you sell? What will you exchange?
What we do. Yeah, so look, man, as you say, Bitcoin, it is a superior technology, but it does not mean that we can skip the design thinking. There's a lot to discuss. There's a lot to talk about. And having our best people on it, you know, having our brightest engineers, our best designers, our best leaders, you know, putting their time and effort, like you've committed your time and effort to working on this. I think it's an incredible time, very exciting. But Stephen, if people want to follow your work, they want to see what you're up to. I mean, where do you want to send them?
Not much. I'm pretty private. Like, I mean, I'm not really a content producer, but I'm on X, Stephen Hay. Maybe you put it in the footnotes in your show there. And then I have I do strategic consulting, so for design and strategy and innovation. But I also have a design agency, which is a collaboration with a buddy of mine who had a fantastic design agency, and I orange built him. So we said, you know what? We were looking at all the design companies, and he's my friend Alfredo. He's a master brand builder, brand designer. He was like, the one thing that all these companies have in common is bad design, bad branding design. So we said, all right, well, let's create an agency. So we created Chaos. It's CAOS.global. So we have an agency to help Bitcoin companies at least get that part right. Their branding, the logo, the communication. And then I do most of more strategic work one-to-one. So, but feel free to reach out, design at Stephen.
That's awesome. Thank you. And I guess you mentioned you're going to move down to Patagonia. What's next on your radar? What's on your horizon?
Yeah, so the idea, we're going to set up a camp in the small little town of Puerto Varas, which is in the Patagonia where we're from originally after 12 years. And the idea is to create a Bitcoin epicenter there, a little Bitcoin community, little circular economy. Engage in education. We're doing partnership education with some of the local universities. And then also, orange peeling as many people as we can, both in different aspects of society. So we're working with artisans, you know, it's really teaching them about banking and self sovereignty and how to save, working with small companies to see the benefits of Bitcoin adoption and things like payments and things like this. And also working with large organizations like universities and family offices. Again, all the same, education about Bitcoin, why Bitcoin is important, two, a little bit of how it works, and three, what can they do? How do they act? How do they start participating in with Bitcoin?
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, look, I really appreciate your time, Stiven. It's been really interesting to talk design thinking and how we can apply it to Bitcoin. And thank you.
Thanks so much for your time, Cody. It's a pleasure to talk.
Thank you for listening. I am Cody Allingham, and that was The Transformation of Value. If you would like to support this show, please consider making a donation either through my website or by directly tipping to the show's Bitcoin wallet, or just pass this episode on to a friend who you think may enjoy it. And you can always email me at hello@thetransformationofvalue.com.